Good afternoon. Good afternoon and welcome to the National Press Club. My name is Monroe Carman. I am president of the club and editor-at-large at Bloomberg Business News. I'd like to welcome our club members and their guests in the audience, as well as those of you watching on C-SPAN or listening to this program on National Public Radio or the Global Internet Computer Network. Before introducing our head table, I'd like to remind our members of coming speakers. On Tuesday, October 17th, Don Hewitt, executive producer of 60 Minutes, will be here to address us, and I'm sure we'll be asked some questions about cameras in the courtroom. On Wednesday, October 18th, the Secretary of Agriculture, Daniel Glickman, will be with us. And on Thursday, October 19th, there will be a debate on the federal budget. Seems that we have a debate every year on the federal budget, but this one will be will feature Alice Rivlin, the director of the Office of Management and Budget, and Representative John Kasich, chairman of the House Budget Committee. Transcripts and audio and video tapes of press club luncheons are available by calling 1-800-NPC-2334. I'm also pleased to announce the publication of a new book, and we hope it will be an annual one. It's called The National Press Club's Best Contemporary Speakers, a book containing 13 of the best speeches made during 1994. To order a copy, again, call 1-800-NPC-2334. And if you have any questions for today's speaker, whom I hope we will be able to include, and I expect that we will be able to include in our 1995 version of our best speeches of the year, if you have any questions for him when he's done, write. You'll find some cards on your table. Write them on the cards, pass them up, and I will ask as many as time permits. I'd now like to introduce our head table guests and ask them to stand briefly when their names are called. From your right, Tom Rhodes of the London Times, Charlotte Grimes, St. Louis Post-Dispatch, Jim Anderson, German Press Agency, Andrew Mosier, Assistant Foreign Editor, The Washington Post, Raphael Callas, Executive Editor and Vice President, United Press International, Mrs. Susan Baker, spouse of our speaker. Those of you who know me over the years do recall that I specialized in exclusive stories, scoops, if you will. Well, I have one today. This is Mrs. Baker's birthday. Skipping over our speaker, moving down the table, Mark Johnson, Media General News Service and Chairman of the Press Club Speakers Committee. James Baker IV, son of our speaker. Dale Montgomery, Washington editor, GPS World Magazine, and member of the Speakers Committee who arranged today's luncheon. Thank you, Hale. A lot of work, I know. Abdul Salam Masaru, Arab American Media Services and President of the Foreign Correspondents Association. Johanna Newman, foreign editor, USA Today, and Carol Giacomo, diplomatic correspondent for Reuters News Agency. It is my pleasure today to introduce our guest speaker, James A. Baker III, the master of politics and statecraft, who now has ventured into an even more perilous endeavor called authorship. As you all know, Secretary Baker has written a book entitled Politics of Diplomacy, Revolution, War, and Peace, 1989 to 1992. Sorry about that. In it, he chronicles his years as President George Bush's Secretary of State, years that witnessed the ascendancy of American diplomacy as communism collapsed in Europe. Secretary Baker's book is not light reading. It's more than 670 pages, but he does discuss a wide range of crucial and historic world events, from the resignation of Soviet Premier Gorbachev, to the removal of Panamanian President Noriega, to the reasons why it was decided to end the Persian Gulf War, even though Iraqi President Saddam Hussein was still in power. Secretary Baker has served three presidents besides President Bush. He served Ronald Reagan as White House Chief of Staff and Secretary of the Treasury, and Gerald Ford as Undersecretary of Commerce. He also was the commanding presence in the political campaigns of the three presidential candidates, the Republican presidential candidates over the last five presidential elections. Mr. Baker has so many titles and awards that we wouldn't have time for your questions if I tried to list them all, so I won't. But I can say he presently is a senior partner in the Houston law firm of Baker & Botts. He's honorary chairman of the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy at Rice University, and he serves on the board of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, as well as on the boards of many other nonprofit organizations. On a personal note, I must say I owe a debt of gratitude to Secretary Baker. I covered him when he was Secretary of the Treasury. And I remember going up to chat with him, and I was prepared to write a major cover story on the death of the Tax Reform Act of 1986. At the time, he warned me that the reports of the death of tax reform were greatly exaggerated. I reconsidered. I did not write that story. I said tax reform still had a chance. It was enacted. He made me look good, and I thank you very much for that. Now I want to make him look good by getting out of his way. But before I do, I want to point to one other accomplishment that Secretary Baker neglects to mention in his book. It occurred on May 21st, 1985. It was on that date that Secretary Baker came over from the Treasury to dedicate the cornerstone of the renovated National Press Building. So as you walk out and go in the lobby, you will see his name there engraved in our marble cornerstone right next to Calvin Coolidge. We remember him fondly for that gesture, and we welcome him warmly to the National Press Club today. Ladies and gentlemen, James A. Baker III.
Thank you, Bud, very much for a warm introduction. I realize I'm getting a little bit older, but the book does not cover the 19th century, notwithstanding the fact that my name is on a cornerstone down there along with Calvin Coolidge's name. I'm really pleased to be back here at the National Press Club, ladies and gentlemen, and I'm pleased to see so many familiar faces again. Bud told you that I practice law, but I'm not going to tell any lawyer jokes today. Because we lawyers now, if you go out there and take a poll of the American people, we're way down at the bottom along with members of Congress and union leaders and some would say members of the press. But I'm not going to tell lawyer jokes because when people ask me what I do these days, I no longer say that I'm a lawyer. I say I'm a politician. Goes over better. Standing before you here today, I find it really hard not to think back to the first time that I addressed this group as Secretary of State, and that was back in June of 1989, when the Iron Curtain divided Europe. The Soviet Union was still fully intact as a state and as a superpower. Middle East peace was really only a pipe dream, and Kuwait was a small country a long, long ways away, about which Americans knew practically nothing. And little did we know at that time what was to follow in the short space of just three or a little over 3 years. And as I reflect back now on my time as Secretary of State, I'm really struck as I reflect back with the benefit of some distance on my good fortune in occupying the office during a time when the world changed, and it changed really profoundly, and it changed irrevocably. As my book would indicate, it really was a time of revolution. It was a time of war. And it was a time of peace because we had a revolution of freedom sweep away communism. We had a war of liberation that reversed a dictator's aggression. And we had not complete peace, but at least progress toward peace. Not a peace to end all peace, but at least a foothold of a region of enmity and conflict. From 1945 to 1989, or through 1989, 11 secretaries of state steered this country's way across a geopolitical map that was shaped by World War II and by the Cold War. And then in just 3.5 years, those boundaries were permanently redrawn. Indeed, I would argue that the very nature of the international system as we had known it was transformed. And since that time, I have felt a special obligation to share some of the experiences and insights and implications of those years. That's one of the reasons that I have spent as much time as I have helping developed the Baker Institute for Public Policy at Rice University, and it's one of the reasons that I have focused this book, which is really not a memoir in the classical sense, why I focused this book on my State Department years And not on the years with Bud at the Treasury, and not on the years at the White House, not on the years of those presidential campaigns, but because the changes that took place in that short 3.5 years were so profound. Now, conducting diplomacy or practicing foreign policy, as anybody who's been involved in it would tell you, it takes a lot of hard work, and it takes a lot of effort. And speaking of hard work, reminds me of the one story I want to share with you this afternoon that my boss Ronald Reagan used to always tell about the fellow from my home state of Texas who wanted very badly to be a farmer. So he went down there and he bought some land in Texas. And it wasn't very good land. It had a lot of brush on it, boulders and rocks. But he was determined to be the very best farmer that he could be. So he went out there and he worked from sunrise to sunset every day of the week, morning, noon, and night. He cleared the brush, he all the rocks away, he cultivated, he planted. Pretty soon he had a really first-rate farm. So proud of his farm was he that he invited his preacher down to see it. And as they were walking through the place that day, they went to the first plot, and the preacher leaned over and he picked up this cantaloupe, and he said, "Look at this luscious, juicy cantaloupe." He said, "God is good." He went to the second plot, he pulled an ear of corn off the stalk, and he said, "In this juicy, plump, sweet corn," he said, "praise the Lord." He went to the third plot and he picked a tomato and he said, "And look at this really ripe, juicy, plump tomato." He said, "The Lord has really blessed this place." The farmer was getting a little bit nervous about that time. He leaned over to him and he said, "Preacher," he said, "I wish you could have seen this place when the Lord was taking care of it all by himself." And the only point of the story is that with the Lord's help, we worked hard during those years from 1989 to 1992. The battles were hard fought, and the victories, a lot of them, didn't come too easily. And I think that from our successes and from our failures, and we had failures as well as successes, as I point out in the book, I think that there's some lessons to be learned. And I want to share with you today three of those lessons, lessons that I think have significant ramifications, not just for historians, but for the conduct, present-day conduct of foreign policy. The first of those lessons is that far from being removed from politics, diplomacy is, I think, in fact, a continuation of politics on a different level. The second lesson is that foreign policy has been radically transformed by developments in communications technology, such as faxes, modems, and yes, such as CNN. The third is that despite the communications revolution, the personalities and the idiosyncrasies of individual leaders really remain decisive in shaping international affairs. And so let me begin with what I call the politics of diplomacy. In some ways, I think Senator Vandenberg was absolutely right. Politics should stop at the water's edge because, as we all know, frequently partisan bickering really directly undermines foreign policy. I think President Bush and I understood that every important achievement of the post-war era really enjoyed bipartisan support and pretty much on a sustained basis. And so we were determined when we began to try at least to make that a hallmark of our administration. We weren't completely successful, but at least we, I think, recognized the importance of it and we tried. Yet when you step back and you look at politics, not in the sense of electoral campaigns or campaign politics, but in its higher sense, I think it's clear that politics and policy are inextricably linked. And it's really only through the political system that we can transform philosophy into policy in this country and indeed in any country. So in that sense, most political strategy, I would argue, is oftentimes nothing more than common sense. It's the transformation of ideas into action in light of certain realities and in pursuit of specific goals. This is particularly true, I think, in international politics or geopolitics. Success there, as many people in this audience, faces I see in this audience know, success is often predicated on the ability to understand how political constraints on all sides will inevitably shape the outcome of any negotiation. Indeed, I would argue, with a nod to Clausewitz, that diplomacy is the continuation of politics, whether in revolution or in war or in peace. We sometimes overlook the fact, I think, that most foreign leaders are themselves politicians. Not all of them, but most of them. These leaders view their problems and their opportunities with political glasses on. To persuade them, I think you need to try and put yourself in their shoes to the extent that you can. You need to help them explain, justify, and even rationalize their positions to their colleagues and to their publics. And I want to tell you, there was scarcely a meeting that we had with Gorbachev or Shevardnadze that didn't include a lengthy digression on their intractable domestic problem. It was almost always the first topic of discussion after the first meeting or so that we had, almost always the first topic of discussion, and I think understandably so. In formulating our agenda for these sessions, I understood very clearly that any initiatives on my part, while they had to be fundamentally rooted in American national interests, also needed to take into account their needs, notably a Soviet public that was demanding an improved standard of living and that was very fearful that perestroika would make things worse, not better. And indeed, in the short term, it did make things worse, not better. And they're still having a tough time. The point I'm making is this. When we negotiated with them, we worried not just about how our Soviet policy was going to play in Peoria, but how it played on the streets of Moscow or Leningrad. That doesn't mean that American foreign policy bent to Soviet public opinion. It never did. It merely means that we knew and were aware of, appreciated the constraints on the Soviet leadership. Let me suggest that American public opinion is carefully assessed by other countries as well, particularly in this case by Moscow. I remember in June of 92, when Boris Yeltsin had become the first freely elected Republican leader, and on the eve of his departure for a Washington summit here with President Bush, he had disclosed to the press that there might be some Vietnam-era American prisoners of war still alive in the former Soviet Union. Well, there was a huge controversy over here about that, as there properly should have been. The controversy threatened to cloud the entire trip. In response, President Bush privately suggested that Yeltsin pledge in his remarks to a joint session of the Congress that he would leave no stone unturned in his search for American POWs. Yeltsin accepted the president's suggestion nearly verbatim, and the result was that the joint session of the Congress gave him a very, very enthusiastic standing ovation. The point is, it was a political stroke that bolstered Yeltsin here, and it also cleared out the underbrush for passage of the Freedom Support Act for assistance to the former Soviet Union. At our suggestion, he very well understood that his words could unlock that legislation in a way that no words from the administration ever could. Yeltsin's understanding of public diplomacy brings me to my second lesson. There's a conception out there, I think, rather broadly held on the part of the American people, that diplomacy is the exclusive province of Ivy League elitists in striped pants with a strange lingo of their own. That diplomacy is conducted in secret meetings, always in secret negotiations with secret agendas and with no input or import to Main Street Americans. Let me suggest to you that as an Estonian and a public servant with some reputation for secrecy, I think I am uniquely qualified to dispense with that falsehood. Undoubtedly, I think there was a time when classical diplomacy, that is, secret negotiations between governments, dominated international relations. And secrecy still has, of course, its place in the conduct of our foreign policy and in the conduct of our national security policy, but much, much less so than before. And today I would argue to you that the communications revolution is one of the defining characteristics of the post-Cold War era. Faxes, cellular phones, satellites, all of these things have reduced the time it takes to convey information from one side of the world to the other. CNN, in particular, has made news a real-time business and has radically shortened the time governments have for decision-making. It was our experience, particularly toward the end of my tenure as Secretary of State, that decisions often had to be made on the fly, and that, of course, increases the risks of mistakes. But it's not just the speed of these new technologies that is important. It's that the news media now have technological capabilities that are every bit as advanced as governments, if not more so. In fact, it is a fact of life that journalists today report more quickly than governments, especially since most embassy reporting has to go through stricter verification procedures. And that means, for example, I think that during crises, governments now need to react to media reports at every bit as much or more than they have to react to reports from their own intelligence services. During the Soviet coup in August of 1991, the events were moving so rapidly from hour to hour, really from minute to minute, that we, most of us, stopped reading cables, and embassies really stopped sending cables. Instead, we'd work pretty much with the phone glued to our ear and our eyes on the television set to see what the latest developments were over there in Moscow. Technology can be a useful tool for government policymakers to send messages as well as to receive those messages. I gave a speech just before the air war began in a hangar in Taif, Saudi Arabia, to a group of American pilots and crews that I knew would be in the first wave of a war that I knew would begin in 4 or 5 days. And that speech, while it was aimed at those brave airmen in the audience, was also very much aimed at an audience of one in Baghdad that we knew was also tuned in to his television set to get the best possible read that he could on America's intentions. The same thing is true for President Bush's Rose Garden statement that he made on the second day of the coup against Gorbachev. The point I'm making is simply this. Instead of using diplomatic channels, we sent unmistakable strategic signals instantaneously, globally, and dramatically through the new technology. The power of the global communications revolution, I suppose, was driven home for me many times while I was Secretary of State, but perhaps never more forcefully than on the occasion of my last chance to avoid war meeting with Tariq Aziz in Geneva on January the 9th. The war was when the deadline was January 15th. That effort failed, but the power of the global communications revolution was really driven home when at my post-meeting press conference, I began a carefully crafted statement with the word regrettably. First word I uttered, regrettably. The stock market immediately reeled. From 40 points up, the Dow Jones closed down more than 39. Oil prices, in the space of about 5 minutes, just hearing on the strength of hearing that word, jumped from $23 to $31 a barrel. Now, that's the effect of the global technological or communications revolution, but let me say that it can oftentimes be a double-edged sword. When the Berlin Wall came down, a lot of us felt an overwhelming euphoria. This was truly freedom's victory after 40 years, a seminal event. But we didn't think we could welcome that event any way other than diplomatically, really almost clinically, without sticking a stick in the eye of the leadership in the Soviet Union in a manner that might cause us significant problems. The Cold War, after all, didn't have to end with a whimper. It could have ended with a bang. We took a lot of criticism at the time for what was a very tempered and modest reaction to a tremendously significant event. But we really couldn't, given the nature of the global communications revolution, we really couldn't say publicly what we all felt privately. Technology can also alter the process of consensus making and therefore decision making. To build domestic support for the Gulf War, for instance, we used all forms of media, radio and television interviews, speeches, congressional testimony, op-eds. Most notably, the Bush administration encouraged the Congress to vote on the war. We encouraged the Congress to vote on the war, not because we thought it was constitutionally required, because we believe strongly, and I continue to believe very strongly, that the President of the United States has the power to commit our armed forces without the concurrence of Congress. Congress can cut off the purse strings, of course, but I think the President has the foreign policy power and certainly the power as Commander-in-Chief. But we felt it was important because we thought that the extensive coverage of the congressional debates would further solidify the domestic consensus we were trying to build behind that policy. And we learned later that indeed it did, and it was really fundamental because when we first started talking about sending forces to the Persian Gulf, it was tremendously unpopular in this country and with the Congress. So the point I'm making is really this. The new technology both widens the attentive public that is focused on foreign policy, and it improves the executive branch's ability to play to that widened public. Now, those are all upsides. Everything that I've mentioned so far about the technological revolution, but there's one major drawback, and that is that that this new technology makes everything that happens around the world much more important. Technology really has shrunk the globe. So we have the horrors of Bosnia and Rwanda and Somalia, and you name it. We have them in American living rooms nightly, and we have demands, therefore, to do something, demands to the Congress, demands to the executive branch. And this has a very profound, and I would submit to you, sometimes disturbing effect on American interests and policy. And the reason I say that is that all too often today, what is deemed vital is what is on television. That makes almost every event around the globe at least a potential crisis, even if it is not integral to the national interest or the national security interest of the country. Let me give you an example. I would argue strongly to you that the future of reform in the Russian Federation is really a lot more important to the national interest of the United States than the conflict in Bosnia, as regrettable as that humanitarian nightmare, which was my term, as regrettable as that humanitarian nightmare, and yet we don't see much on reform in Russia. We don't see much day-to-day coverage. How is it going? What's happening? When what is vital to American interests is a knee-jerk reaction to what the American people are seeing on their television screens, then we have foreign policy by television to some extent. And when we have foreign policy by television, we really have no foreign policy at all, I think, unless you subscribe to the theory that the United States should be the policeman for the world. And I don't subscribe to that theory, and I don't think any American president can long command a consensus on the part of the American people for the support of a policy that would make us policemen to the world. I think we need to realize that there are inherent limits to the actions that we can take, that we can take and sustain with the public. Now, that view is not a pleasant one. I think it's especially painful in the world that I just described, where televised horrors in other parts of the world are a real part of our everyday lives. But we live in a real world, and we need to admit it. We live in a real and not a theoretical world. Managing conflict entails significant costs, and these costs are borne by individual citizens of individual states. I'm talking now about nation states. But they can include financial burdens, they can include danger, and of course, even death. Therefore, it is therefore not just predictable, but appropriate, I think, that democratic governments weigh carefully the costs against the disadvantages of intervention. I think that those kind of clear-headed assessments have to be made. They're necessary if this country is going to avoid open-ended and costly commitments. And I think that a pragmatic approach such as that, if I may say so, will help governments generate public support that's going to be required when it really is an important, vital national that is involved, and we need to build consensus to support, let's say, a military intervention somewhere. That brings me to the third and last lesson. And the third lesson is the centrality of the human factor in the conduct of diplomacy. Many people subscribe to an opposite notion that nations have permanent, immutable interests which serve or should serve as scripture for foreign policymakers. Henry John Temple, in 1848, we do get back to the 19th century, but told the House of Commons, our interests are eternal and perpetual, and these interests it is our duty to follow. I would suggest to you, my friends, that this view fails on several levels to take into account human side of the equation. While national interests are a defining feature of foreign policy, what I think really matters most in the long run is the man behind the desk. I had the good fortune, the really extremely good fortune, to be part of a Bush national security team that consisted of a group of experienced and collegial peers. We had all worked together before, in one capacity or another, for prior administrations. We liked each other, we respected each other, and we were friends. That's not to suggest that we didn't disagree, because we disagreed a lot. We argued like crazy, and we argued loudly. But ultimately, we knew we trusted one another, and we left those disagreements behind closed doors. And I would suggest that that is really important in terms of America's foreign policy interests. Established lines of authority were respected, and we were all determined to ensure that to the extent we possibly could, the United States of America would speak with one voice. We saw ourselves as a team, and in my book at least, I suggest that we worked accordingly. Less cohesive foreign policy teams are, I think, simply by definition, less apt to promote a coherent policy. Let me say, with respect to my personal situation, my personal relationship with George Bush left me unprecedented leeway as Secretary of State. After all, we had been friends for over 30 years. I was his political counselor and advisor. Because of this bond and because we were so often on the same wavelength on political and policy matters, I had his trust. When I needed a presidential decision, I didn't have to worry about access. I didn't have to worry about having to wait for that decision. I didn't have to worry about whether sufficient presidential time and attention would be devoted to the particular foreign policy problem. I had immediate access. He defended me even when I was wrong, and there were plenty of times when I was wrong, but he defended me. He supported me. He protected me. And every Secretary of State needs this if he is going to be effective for this country. Because in this town, everybody wants a part of the Secretary of State's turf. Everybody wants to play in that sandbox. But I never had to look over my shoulder, never once. When it comes to leadership, I would suggest to you that personality is human factor, is destiny. If George Bush had been the least bit timid or wishy-washy, the United States would never have gone to Kuwait to reverse Iraqi aggression. For that matter, had Saddam Hussein been more rational about the consequences of his actions, Iraq might not have invaded Kuwait when it did. Of course, if that had happened, ironically enough, he might be sitting today in a substantially stronger military position with a lethal arsenal of chemical and biological and probably nuclear weapons. But from one end of the spectrum of world leaders to the other, I think we see how personality really becomes policy. Mikhail Gorbachev's boldness, for instance, led him to begin a process that resulted in the dismantling, complete dismantling of an economic and political system that had defined his country and the world as I had known it for my entire life. Take Shevardnadze. Shevardnadze's courage led him to accept an American-Soviet arms embargo against Iraq, even though he'd never cleared that with his president. So personality matters. The human factor is really important. Let me conclude, ladies and gentlemen, with a broader observation. The world can change in ways that have nothing to do with leaders or diplomats, statesmen. That happened on November the 9th, 1989, when the wall came down. A month later, I went to Berlin, and as I peered through a crack in the wall at what was the high-resolution drabness of East Berlin, it really struck me that the ordinary men and women of East Germany had peacefully and persistently taken history into their own hands. This really was their revolution. We diplomats, I think, can and should take very, very little credit, if any. It may have taken a leap of faith, but faith was something that these people had in very ample supply. So from Almaty to Vilnius and Albania to Mongolia, we saw the people during this period of time take destiny into their own hands and show once and for all that freedom really does work. What was true then, I think, is equally true now. And that is that the principal responsibility for the changed world that we live in lies in the ordinary men and women who seek freedom, who struggle against the darkness of totalitarianism, and who rise up and seize liberty for them. Thank you very much.
Now comes the hard part, the questions. There are a number of them that ask questions about the decision to end the Gulf War, even though Saddam Hussein was still in power. And I'm going to try to combine them a little bit by saying that the major part of the Iraqi military escaped largely intact in Desert Storm, as did Iraq's nuclear and chemical war production facilities. Given a second chance, or a second look at it, would you advise a more vigorous Allied offensive to neutralize the Iraqi forces and disarm their suspected war-making facilities?
Bud, let me quarrel with the assumption of the question. The majority of Iraqi forces did not escape destruction. Some did. Of course, there were some Republican Guards divisions that were never sent to the Kuwaiti front. And I would also take issue with the statement that the nuclear and chemical and biological weapons capabilities of Iraq escape destruction. We destroyed an awful lot of that in an air campaign that lasted almost 5 weeks, I think. The rest of it has now been disclosed under duress, under United Nations Security Council sanctions to UN inspectors. And I think we have Saddam Hussein in a pretty good, in a pretty tight cage now. And these sanctions that were imposed upon him at the end of the war, in my opinion, will not be lifted until there is complete compliance with all of them. And they're more than simply those that have to do with his weapons of mass destruction. But let me address the more fundamental point about ending the war. Every one of the president's political and military advisors, beginning with the chain of command in the field, with Norm Schwarzkopf, with Colin Powell, Dick Cheney, Brent Scowcroft, Jim Baker, everybody in the political and military chain as senior advisors to the president recommended that he terminate the war when he did. The military's recommendation was based primarily on the fact that we had achieved our war aims and our political aims both. We were operating under Security Council resolution. We were killing literally thousands of people who were trying to escape, fleeing. They were fleeing up that highway of death. I think if we had continued the war, we would have frayed the coalition, the Arab member of the coalition. Many of them would have left us. We would not have today, in my opinion, an active, ongoing peace process in the Middle East. That window of opportunity was created by the Gulf War, the defeat of Iraq. But if we'd gone on to occupy that big country, we would have lost some Arab coalition partners. We would also have lost some more American lives. And everybody who makes this suggestion never gives any thought or consideration to how many more Americans would have lost their lives. The military didn't want to occupy a huge country like that. It took us 2 weeks to find Noriega in a little country like Panama where we had military bases. Who's to say we could ever have found Saddam up there in Baghdad? We would have lost a lot more Americans. It was the wrong thing to do. It would have gone beyond the authority we had from the Security Council. And I am absolutely convinced that ending the war when we did was the right move to make. And by the way, there's almost a chapter in the book that deals exclusively with that, if I've left anything out.
Several questions on the future of the United Nations in peacekeeping. Do United Nations peacekeeping forces really enforce the peace, or do they merely confirm and prolong the basic conflict?
Well, first there has to be a peace to keep, and as we've learned, regrettably, in Bosnia, peacekeepers were inserted, and there was no peace to keep. And that's one of the problems, frankly, and when we begin to talk about whether or not we're going to make the largest deployment of American military forces since the Gulf War and send 20,000 Americans to peacekeep in Bosnia. The history of the region is that they don't keep peace agreements. They don't even keep ceasefires. They've been fighting for a long, long time. It is a very dangerous, dangerous situation. At the very least, the policy needs to be explained, I think, to the American people. What is our political aim in sending peacekeepers in there? What are the rules of engagement? What is our exit strategy? What are we going to do about the Congress? Is the Congress going to be asked to approve and support the president in what is a very major step? That's U.S. You ask about U.N. The United Nations works best when it gets leadership from its primary member nations, principally, if I may say so, the United States. I think the way the United Nations operated in the Gulf War was the appropriate way to do it. It was a United Nations action, but there was very firm leadership. We worked very hard to pull that coalition together and to get the votes for a number of resolutions in the Security Council. And I think that's how the United Nations is best used. Now, there are other places where great powers are going to be very reluctant to commit forces. I think of a nightmare like Rwanda, and there needs to be some way to deal with these problems. And if the United Nations is not going to be utilized for that purpose, I'm not sure what organization can be or will be. I think the United Nations served a very useful purpose and function in Cambodia in brokering a peace agreement there and in helping to enforce that peace agreement. So I think that there is a role for the United Nations, but primarily, it operates best when there's great power leadership.
Thank you. Several questions on the Clinton administration's foreign policy. Given the course of events in Bosnia, Haiti, and the Middle East, should President Clinton get better marks for foreign policy now than he earned earlier in his administration? And would you please comment specifically on the current policy in Bosnia?
Well, I made a comment a minute ago in answer to that UN question about Bosnia, but the answer to the question is yes, I think he should get better marks than before. I think that the thrust of the question is there's been a steep learning curve, and I think that there has been a steep learning curve. But I personally have supported the administration in its approach on GATT and on NAFTA. On Mexico, I testified before the Congress in support of what the administration did there, in its policy with respect to the Middle East and its policy toward Russia. Those are all very important issues, and I supported them from the very beginning in those. That's not to say that we have not had some serious inconsistencies in our policy approaches in other areas. China comes to mind. Japan comes to mind. North Korea, as far as I'm concerned, comes to mind. Bosnia certainly comes to mind, where we threatened the use of force any number of times only to pull back. And now we are considering following through on a commitment that the President made way back in February of 1993 to send American ground forces into that situation. To enforce a peace. Now, so far there's no peace to enforce, and I'm quite confident that the commitment only applies once there is a peace agreement. But I think it's really important that the country, that if this is going to be done, the largest deployment since the Persian Gulf, the country should really support it. It is a dangerous proposition. That is a dangerous area there. Unfortunately, American peacekeepers become targets, as we saw in Somalia. It's easy to imagine these factions who've been fighting each other for literally centuries taking advantage of that situation. What is our exit strategy? What is our political goal? What is it that we seek there? Do we seek a peace agreement that will confirm Bosnia-Herzegovina as a unitary state and it will be real and substantive? Or are we ready to ratify a de facto partition of that country and, in effect, give the Serbs 50% of what they've conquered through their aggression? Isn't it going to be difficult for Americans to serve as peacekeepers when we have been bombing the Serbs? Will we be able to be seen as impartial peacekeepers? Those are serious questions that need to be debated, and I really think that they need to be debated up on the Hill. I have to say I don't think I would have made that commitment if I'd been in a position to do it. It seems to me that the United States can lead without having to fight its fourth war in history this century on the ground in Europe. We've had two hot ones and a cold one that we've fought in Europe this century. This dispute is of long standing. It is taking place on Europe's doorstep. It seemed to me that the United States could say, okay, we will devote our technology, our air assets, our naval assets, logistical support. And Europe, with a capital E, Europe, you furnish the ground forces. This really should not be America's war, and unfortunately, our people will be targets over there to a far greater extent than any Europeans will be. So there are a lot of questions. I really think it would be important to take the matter up with the Congress in order to try and build domestic support for the largest deployment since the Persian Gulf.
Secretary Baker, your book's subtitle conspicuously omits economics. Why do subjects like trade agreements, Japan and Mexico, have so few index entries and receive such scanty treatments?
Well, as you pointed out when you mentioned the book, Bud, it's 670 pages, and it took that long, it took that many pages to present the international economic policy issues in a complete chapter of its own and still deal with the revolutionary changes that took place in the world over those 3.5 years. I do talk about the trade agreements. I talk about the importance of international economic policy. I talk about the role that I played in it during those years. But as you know, I have always believed that the Treasury should have the lead in international economics. And I said so in a speech to the State Department when I first arrived over there in January of 1989. I do deal with those issues. They are extremely important. In the first speech I made to the department, I said, you are getting a Secretary of State who was a Secretary of the Treasury and who has seen us trade economic chits for foreign policy gains for far too long. And we're not going to do it on my watch. And we didn't. But I deal with it as best I can, given the limitations of space and the other revolutionary events that took place in the world during that 3 years.
Speaking of scanty treatment, who was the vice president during the Bush administration? Why did he not get mentioned by name in your book? And are you trying to settle old scores, political scores?
Bud, the vice president is mentioned on page 338, where he and I argued forcefully to the president and his other advisors that we take the Gulf War issue to the Congress. And I think we were both right in doing so.
Who would you like to see get the Republican presidential nomination? And secondly, do you think Colin Powell will seek it? Does he have a chance of getting it? And would you like to see him get it? There's a whole combination there.
Having worked for 20 years to build a national Republican Party, my hope is that if Colin decides to run for president, he will run as a Republican. Because if he runs as an independent or on a third-party ticket, he will hurt us because he will draw votes from us. We must be seen to be the alternative since we are the party out of power in the White House. We have to be seen to be the alternative to President Clinton. So if he runs, I hope very much that he will run as a Republican. Can he get the Republican nomination? I cannot answer that question, and nobody can for you today. You really won't know the answer to a question like that unless he gets in there and rolls up his sleeves and goes and does the very things that you have to do to get a party's nomination. As far as my support is concerned, it's going to go to our nominee, whoever it is. Because I have tried to build this party nationally for 20 years, and I'll be quite prepared to help our nominee in any way. We've got a lot of other good candidates out there who've been out there for over 2 years, working hard, doing the kind of things that you have to do if you want a party's nomination, and they're tough things. It's hard to do. There are a lot of them out there, a lot of good candidates, friends of mine with whom I've worked for a long time, that have been out there for over 2 years doing it.
Speaking of Republicans, is it true, as Marlon Fitzwater writes, that former Congressman Jack Kemp lunged at you during a disagreement in the Oval Office? And what was the disagreement about?
You see why people wanted me to write a book about what happened in the Ford and Bush and Reagan White Houses. There was no such. What I think he wrote in his book was that there was fisticuffs in the Oval Office or something. What he's really referring to, and when Jack was asked the question on a TV show here not long ago, and the question came at him this way: is it true that Brent Scowcroft had to break up a scuffle between you and Jim Baker? And Jack said, Brent Scowcroft's not big enough to break up a scuffle between me and Jim Baker if we decided to fight. But the fact of the matter is, we weren't going to fight. We were probably having a rather vigorous disagreement orally. That's all I remember about it.
Well, thank you, sir. Before we get to our final question, a couple of gifts. The first is a certificate of appreciation for being with us, and I know you have several of those. This is our famous National Press Club coffee mug. You have what, two of those?
Yeah, I've got two or three of those.
All right, we're going to make a complete set before we're through. We hope you will come back.
Thank you.
Last question, a number of things, giveaways, and personal plans. Well, no, let me combine this. Will George Bush ever run again for public office? Number one. Meaning the presidency. Number two, would you be willing to run for public office or serve in the cabinet in the next administration? Or, give me another option, run as an independent with Ross Perot's backing. So you have all.
Well, with respect to question three, I have tried for 20 years to build a Republican Party nationally, and I will support a Republican Party, not an independent party. I don't have any plans to run for anything, as I indicated to you. And with respect to President Bush's possible plans, I think you really need to direct that question to him, not to me. I really don't. I really wouldn't want to express an opinion on it or try and speak for him. I see a lot of him. We are neighbors right there in Houston, Texas, just as we were before He started his first campaign for president back here in 1979.
That seems to leave the door a little bit ajar for the possibility of President Bush running again. Is that true? You didn't close it.
I can't.
You didn't lock it.
I can't close it. It's not up to me to close it.
But you see him all the time in Houston.
Well, but I mean, that's not for me to say. I think it would be inappropriate for me to make a statement like that, Bush.
Well, I wouldn't want to urge you to say anything inappropriate, but we do thank you very much for being with us, sir. And let me tell you all, before you leave, I did want to say the Secretary has graciously consented to sign his book in the First Amendment, which is down at the hall at the corner right after the luncheon. So any of you that do have books, why, come by and we'll all be there and he'll sign for you. And thank you all for being with us, and good afternoon.
Thanks, bud.
Okay,
good show.
That's your boy. Not bad.
Good show.
Mark, what do you think?
Oh, that's right.
Thank you very much.
That was
lovely. Thank you.
Hey, I run
it. Would you find that interesting?
Huh?
Yep. All right, well, it was interesting, okay? That's all I care about. Could have so many topics to cover, I just couldn't get how it looked from where. Good. And that's been, I assume. But anyway, he'll be there to sign him.